This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk to a senior first officer who flies the Boeing 787 for a major European airline. We look at the makeup of the proposed 13-member board should air traffic control be spun off the FAA, replacing the T-38C Talon with the Advanced Pilot Trainer, open skies and the charges by some U.S. airlines that Middle Eastern airlines have received unfair subsidies, and a candidate for the top FAA spot. We also have an interview with the commander of 302 Squadron of the Dutch Royal Air Force. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 492 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me first is the other Max, Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He was the 2008 CFI of the year, and he's our expert on learning to fly and purchase the Cirrus aircraft. Hey, Max.
Hello. Great to be here. I have been down for the count. I was sick for about 5 days and finally went flying again today, so I feel hale and hearty again, which is great.
Was that the cure, to go flying?
Well, I don't know. I could tell you that I could tell my ears were slightly blocked. It was like, okay, it was soon enough to go flying and not too soon. I think if I'd gone any sooner, probably the ears would have been totally blocked and that would have been bad.
Yeah, very. All right. Also with us is Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's a flight instructor. He also publishes the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening to everybody across the world. Thank you for joining us.
And also with us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian. Hi, David.
Hi, Max. Hi, everyone. I've recovered from last week. I'm looking forward to a good show tonight.
Great. And I think we're going to have one. And also to help us have a great show is our associate producer, Brian Coleman. Hi, Brian.
Hello, Max and everyone. I kind of feel like David right now. I'm really, really, really upset with the news and just silly, stupid journalism. And I'm looking at this one article. It talks about 7 shameless ways to get an upgrade. And what a bunch of garbage reporting was done here. And I just don't think that there are actually any good ways to get upgrades any longer. But I think maybe our guest tonight can talk about what it's like flying commercial. So
absolutely.
We'll see what happens.
Well, our guest is Senior First Officer Mike. He currently flies the Boeing 787 for a major European airline. He's based out of London Heathrow. Now, Mike started early. He started flying at the age of 17, and he first learned on a Cessna 152. Then he moved on to a Piper PA-28. Eventually, Mike applied for the Advanced Entry Program with a major Middle Eastern airline, and he started flying the A330. Mike progressed to become an MFF CCQ. That's Mixed Fleet Flying, and CCQ is cross-crew qualification, on the A330 and A340 before moving on to the Boeing 787 as part of the entry into service crew for that airline. Well, Mike moved back to Europe in 2016, where he joined his current airline. He holds a number of ratings, CPL, MEIR, ATPL, and he's also a training first officer, a TFO, and a TRI, a type rated instructor. Mike, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. You know, when we talk with pilots that have a lot of experience, it's kind of alphabet soup, you know?
Just a little bit. Thank you very much for having me on the show. It's good to be here. It's a bit late, but, you know, some things are worth staying up for in life, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. We really appreciate you staying up late to talk with us and our audience.
Just to answer Brian's quick question of the 7 shameless ways to get an upgrade? There's only one way to get an upgrade, and everyone knows what that is. It's called paying for it.
Yeah, that's the surefire way, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Mike, we're looking forward to talking with you about flying the 787, as well as some of your experiences maybe in the A330 and the A340. But first, we've got some aviation news to talk about. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Ready from the West.
Our first story comes from Flying Magazine. In fact, this is an article that Rob Mark wrote. Still wondering why GA and BizAv think the airlines will run a privatized ATC system? Well, we know that FAA reauthorization comes through a congressional act. But these reauthorizations can contain a lot more than just funding. They also provide the FAA with mandates and directives. A current example of a requirement that has been in the news a lot lately is the notion of spinning off air traffic control from the FAA. That's popularly called privatization. And one contentious aspect of this is the proposed makeup of the 13-member board. What interests should be represented, in what numbers, how many seats, and so forth. So, Rob, this is an issue that you kind of addressed in this article. What's the story here?
Well, the biggest problem, of course, is that in the discussions about it really is not privatization. I really need to change that nomenclature. I found out today when I did an interview with Bob Poole from the Reason Foundation, who we've had on the show a few times, and Bob corrected me by saying it's really a corporatization move, and a little too much to go through right now on that. But the problem is that the way the legislation is written, it says there's just a single board member from the airline. Well, technically, one board member from the major airline is exactly what it says. However, there's also another member from the regional airlines. There's another member from the cargo airlines. There is another member from the controllers union. There's another member from the Airline Pilots Association, and another board member from airports that represent, I forgot the exact terminology of it, but commercial airport interests. And then two people appointed ad hoc by the DOT secretary. And if you take them all completely out of context, they almost appear to have walls between them, but we know that this topic is so politically charged that there's not a chance in hell that certain groups are not going to ally with each other to get done whatever it is they think needs to be done. And so that was kind of what Bob and I were talking about today, that, well, okay, yeah, there is the politics part, but nobody says that that's going to happen, I'm told. But it also doesn't mean that it couldn't or won't happen. And it's that issue that has some people very, very concerned around the general aviation and BizAv community.
How's it you happen to be talking to Bob Poole?
Well, we were doing an interview for another story I'm working on. And rather than wait until later to talk to him, I thought, you know what? I know we were going to be talking about this tonight, so I set it up for midday today, and we got through quite a bit of discussion. And I honestly I don't know Bob other than having had him here on the show. But you know, again, I think that when you talk to people, you get a certain sense of their commitment one way or another. And I honestly have always found Bob to be a fairly reasonable guy. And it doesn't mean I agree with everything he does or says, but his logic is very very interesting, and it's you know, he's very passionate about what he believes within reason. He doesn't come across as a far out person on either side, and he just thinks he's making the good economic case. And when we get this story finished, you'll see that some of it seems to make sense if you were sitting on the other side of the fence.
Hasn't he really made a career on selling ATC privatization to countries around the world? My recollection, I could be wrong on this, was that he may have written a book on this like 40 years ago and has been kind of promoting this.
Yeah, he wrote
this
one on privatization, and he's been closely tied to the ATC issue for a long time. But again, that's part of his job at the Reason Foundation. And I just think it's funny that I managed to call it the Reasonable Foundation a couple of times. And he said, let's not get ahead of ourselves. And I, so again, I think it's important that we do take some time to give everybody an opportunity to perhaps answer the same questions in their own words and not be interpreted by someone else who has a different perspective, and then let the readers make their own, you know, make their own decisions on that.
Yeah, certainly dialogue is good. It's maybe something that we lack enough of in this country right now. Good, you know, reasonable dialogue.
You know, that's interesting that you say that, Max, because when we finished, we were only going to talk for about 20 minutes and we probably spoke for an hour. And, you know, we went through some questions that he had. I mean, I had mine and he said, but I want to ask a few as well. And so we went through those and he said, you know what? He said, you're the only journalist I know of in recent history that's bothered to take the time to call and have a conversation about this.
Isn't that interesting?
Wow, that's what I said. I said, that is really interesting. Mm.
Well, let's ask Mike. Mike, since you fly for a European airline, is there any chatter about U.S. thoughts to remove air traffic control from the FAA? Does that concern you? Do you see it as just a, you know, somebody else's issue and you're not terribly concerned about it? What can you tell us about what, you know, the view from across the pond might be?
I think the first thing to look at it is that regardless to who owns, you know, whether it's a government, the FAA, or it's a privatized company or whoever, the service that they provide isn't going to change, nor is the quality or training which you guys offer across the whole of the United States. It's not going to change overnight, you know, just because someone else is going to own the entity, it doesn't mean that such pitfalls are going to be that, well, hang on, it's because it's not FAA owned, there's going to be a substandard. You know, I think that's one thing to take into consideration with many things. You know, I think when people think, well, it's going to be privatized, it's going to be a more money orientated entity, I guess. But I think the bigger picture is the quality which they can produce. You know, there is more money in privatization than any FAA, EASA, or whoever around the world, because at the end of the day, it's all charged. I'm just reading through an article from last year. It doesn't say though that when they're hoping for this to be pushed through. And if anyone can just clarify that a bit better at all.
Well, it's part of the bills in the House, in the Senate, bills that would reauthorize and fund the FAA. But that keeps getting pushed out, kicked down the road, if you will, you know, for a variety of different political reasons. So right now the FAA is operating under a continuing resolution. In other words, no changes, funding continues at the current level. But the U.S. Congress is trying to reach a resolution on this, an agreement on this, something that they can all vote for and send to the president for his signature. But there are a lot of different viewpoints as to whether this is a good thing, a bad thing. And so the Congress hasn't acted yet. Rob or Max T, when does the current extension run out? It's pretty near term, isn't it?
End of March.
March, yeah. Okay. So, you know, Mike, to answer your question, you know, if they can reach a consensus, if they can pass legislation by then that either does or doesn't include this, then we'd have something to move forward with. But if they can't, or if they have to pass legislation that doesn't address the issue, that's a possibility also, I guess. So the answer is we don't know when, if ever, the air traffic control system might move out from underneath the FAA.
In terms of, obviously, as a business entity, let's look at that and not the quality of the standard that's going to be produced. What are the positives to that?
Well, the business perspective on that is that they will have, the board will have direct control over how the air traffic control system operates. They want to separate the safety elements of FAA from air traffic. And then They believe that if they have better control over funding, which would come from user fees, which GA and BizAv have been absolved from, they'll be able to institute updates to the technology really much faster, they say, than is going on right now. And of course, when I asked for an example of a corporation here in the United States that operates, that started out as a government entity that became a corporation operating like this, Bob had to admit he didn't know of one. And I said, well, then can you imagine why people might be a little concerned that we're taking a system that seems to run okay? It's probably not as updated as quickly as it could be or should be, but it's incredibly safe. It runs a lot of traffic, and we're going to kind of toss it off the end of the bridge and say, boy, I hope that parachute opens. And that frightens a lot of people.
It's a valid point that if they do just throw it off the edge of the bridge, like you said, let's say in, I don't know, 3, maybe 4, 5 years or however, whichever way they've gone in privatizing this, what happens if it fails? Then what? Does it go back to the FAA?
Well, that's a really good point. And that's something they don't really have anything to say about. And that makes people even more concerned.
Yeah, Congress has basically written a bill that says, we're going to give this away, and we're also going to give up almost all overview of it, which means that consumers and other folks who have complaints have no one to go to except the company that's just been given to, and no process to have it to revert back to the government if the whole thing fails. So, yeah, there are a lot of questions.
But then it's that entity. But we're going back again to that. You know, if let's say, for argument's sake, that it's privatized off to, you know, whoever it was, you know, within that's going to be the bidding for this. You know, let's say they sign a 5-year contract just for, you know, let's play a bit devil's advocate here.
Let's stop for 1 second. There is no bidding for it. This is not privatization where it will be given to the highest bidder. They're proposing to take $53 billion of assets purchased by the taxpayers and giving it to this group that they are creating.
So let's play a bit of devil's advocate with this. Let's say that it's privatized off and they say, right, well, we're going to implement X, Y, and Z new technology into this, and this is going to cost hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And then let's say 5 years' time, they go, we can't sustain this amount of money. We can't sustain the amount of advances. And then it goes back to the FAA or whoever. Who's footing the bill?
The government, as always.
As we say in the States, Mike, beats the hell out of me.
as we say in Europe, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yes.
Well, see, that's a very good point because when I don't want to give away all the details of what I spoke about today, but I mean, I think if you ask the people that support this precisely what the problem is that we're trying to fix, to solve, you seem to get different answers. And that also adds to the anxiety, I think, that people are feeling about this issue. If everybody said it's because of whatever, you know, it's because the tires on the 787 are just too big and we've got to fix them, and everybody agreed. If everybody agreed to the same thing, it might have a little more credence. But unfortunately, I don't think everybody believes the same thing.
Yeah, there was a part in the article I read through earlier on, and I kind of wrote it down because it did make me laugh quite a bit. Something about where they're flying into LaGuardia, where the time between Washington and LaGuardia has increased by, from 67 minutes to 90 minutes since 1990 to 2018, which we're in now, which is 28 years. Now, in that 28 years, would anyone like to tell me how many more people, aircraft companies, you name it, are flying in that 28 years? Are they hoping by privatizing off that we're going to go back to 67 minutes again? No matter who owns it, it's still going to be as busy.
Yes.
And that is the true fact of it all. And the skies are going to get busier. So no matter who owns it, everyone's going to have the same problem.
And I think that's the most disingenuous argument that they bring to the table. If you look at the aircraft that were flying 30 years ago, they were all faster than the aircraft that are currently flying. And every time you take a 737 and go from a Dash 600 to a Dash 700 to a Dash 800, it gets slower. The aircraft we're flying today are slower than the ones we were flying 30 years ago. And back then, we also didn't have the Commerce Department computing on-time arrival statistics. Now all the airlines have changed their schedule so that they can show, hey, we're on time most of the time. How do they do that? They lengthen the scheduled arrival times. So the argument that, gee, it's taking longer to get from Washington to LaGuardia, totally disingenuous. There are all kinds of reasons why it's taking longer, almost none of which have anything to do with air traffic control.
Hmm. Max T, though, if you raise the user fees that all the airlines have to pay, they would reduce the quantity of flights that they have. Therefore, with the lower amount of traffic, they could get there faster. Right?
All I have to do is raise fares. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Just pass it on to the consumers. Yeah, I'm sure they'd all appreciate that.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
But of course, you know, if you think of somebody who you really want to be in charge of complex IT systems, I mean, the airlines, I'm sure, comes to everybody's mind immediately, right? Aren't they the experts on running large, complex systems? I don't think so.
Yeah, we could probably, Max T, we could probably have a whole show on this, I bet.
Yeah, we probably could.
And we did, yes.
Oh, it's evolving, so we should probably move on, I think.
Yeah, let's look at our next story. This is from the Air Force.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm on the next story, aren't I?
Yeah, you better wake up, David, because this comes from the Secretary of the Air Force Public Affairs Office, TX to replace T-38 at pilot training bases. This is a story about the advanced pilot trainer that's supposed to replace the T-38C Talons that are used for jet training. David, we've got a lot of Talons out there. Why are we looking at replacing them?
Well, unlike the B-52, which will be around till the next middle of the next century, T-38s are old. The T-38C program just updated. We haven't built a T-38 since the early 70s. So the young ones are close to pushing 50. The older ones are beyond 50. First of all, the story caught my attention because someone put in the notes that it was Boeing Saab that was actually going to be the aircraft of choice, and I needed to correct Rob because that decision hasn't been made yet. They keep pushing off that decision due to budgetary concerns.
Well, wait a minute. Why did you say someone wrote it in, but then you wanted to correct me?
Well,
thank you, David. No, actually, that's what I thought I read in the story was that was a Boeing Saab venture, but you're saying that's not true.
Well, no, one of the candidates is a Boeing Saab, but it's not been selected yet. It's up against, and there's a bunch of the Scorpion by Textron is one of the candidates. The Lockheed K-50, which is a South Korean derivation of the F-16, is also one of the candidates besides Boeing. So there are multiple candidates. Northrop Grumman produced their own clean sheet aircraft. We saw it taxi around and a couple weeks later decided to pull out of the program. So there's a lot of candidates out there to replace what could be a big business. There's at least a minimum of 500 aircraft being made, plus anything you would see overseas. The T-38 is a phenomenal aircraft, but it's old. And our two flight instructors know that one of the worst things you can do to an airplane is put a rookie pilot in it, which is what T-38s do. The oldest T-38s are usually used as joyrides for people who can't get into their B-2 at least twice a month, or B-52s or U-2s, the high priority things. Also, the T-38s are used as aggressor aircraft. At Langley Air Force Base, they have lots of T-38s, T-38As, some of the oldest, and they are used as fodder for F-22s, and not so much that they're supposed to go dogfight with the F-22s, but they want to put up as many aircraft as they possibly can so that the F-22s get overwhelmed. Not that that ever seems to happen, but so supposedly within the next month and a month and a half, the preliminary candidate will be picked, and supposedly this story is going to the first base is already picked before the aircraft is picked, which is Joint Base San Antonio. And we'll see what happens, who's going to get it. And then, of course, I've been on the show long enough to know that somebody will start saying the thing wasn't fair, and we might have another 2 or 3 years of round and round and round lawsuits as the Air Force tries to pick a trainer for a pilot shortage where they don't have enough pilots and they desperately need trainers for fifth class generation aircraft. The T-38C, even though it has a glass cockpit, is not something you really want to transition someone into an F-35 or an F-22 or whatever the next generation fighters are. So, Rob, just you got to read your stories a little bit better. I know that that's journalism 101, but you just got to be careful what people say, like yourself.
Hey, David, is...
Wait, excuse me. Can I just add one thing to that? Shut up, David! Oh, I'm sorry, Mike. I hope I didn't blast your ears out with that. I thought the TX was the version of the Boeing Saab aircraft. I don't think I realized that is the sort of the generic new fighter trainer. But I do have one question. How come we can run old B-52s but not old T-38s?
Because T-38s are structurally, well, if you want to do what you did with B-52s, you take B-52s and you start harvesting them for parts and parts and parts. And you don't fly multiple missions multiple days. Training aircraft are supposed to be, you know, high volume, putting a lot of stresses on them. And you as instructors know, there's nothing worse than someone bouncing an aircraft on the ground or spinning an aircraft. You're not doing that with a B-52, at least, God, I hope not. All of those training factors that you need to teach a high-quality fighter pilot, you're not going to get in a B-52. So they're not going to – and the B-52s are going to get re-engined. I mean, but the T-38 is long in the tooth. You know, the re-engining was – gave the aircraft a better hot and high climate ability. It's got bigger intakes and a better engine, but it subsequently makes it slower and less maneuverable. So in order to preserve them, we've downgraded them. So it's kind of, even though they got a glass cockpit, which is great, you're talking about an aircraft that we use, if we talk F-5s, to simulate things like big 21s and MiG 15s. And we're perfect aircraft to train people to fly F-15s and F-16s, the early ones. But our technology has moved so far advanced, the trainers haven't caught up with them, you know, and you're going from a turboprop with the T-6 Texan II to a T-38, and then you're going to an F-35. Which is a completely different aircraft. And one of the other things that they want the new aircraft, the TX, to be able to do is to teach more data management and not just flying the aircraft, but all of the data management that's required. And you can't get that in a T-38.
All right. Well, we have one more news story we wanted to touch on. And this comes from Business Insider. Emirates airline boss reveals that the nastiest feud in the airline industry could kill his $76 billion Boeing order. This is about, well, the open skies agreements. I think as most people listening know, open skies agreements govern air travel between countries. They're almost like contracts, really. The Chicago Convention, which is the Convention on International Civil Aviation, that was signed in 1944. It provided a framework for these open skies agreements. And Sir Tim Clark, the president of Emirates, believes that the open skies is at risk and the U.S. aviation industry stands to lose. This comes about because of some U.S. airlines, and that is mainly American, Delta, and United, have accused Emirates, Etihad, and Qatar Airways of receiving over $50 billion in state aid over the past decade, and that's a violation of open skies. Of course, the Middle East carriers deny this claim. Mike, you've flown for a Middle East airline. What's the feeling over there about this issue?
Utter nonsense. to put it bluntly, I think it's a bit of a. I think it's a fight they're trying to have with themselves about no other reason other than, well, you know, they can order shiny jets and we can't. But I think it's a bit of a null and void conversation, and there's an argument. I mean, I was searching through some of the internet the other day and came across the profitability figures for the airlines in the America yesterday. And between United, Delta, and American, pre-tax profits last year was the best part of $11 billion. Now, last year, I think Etihad announced they lost $170 million in, it could be more actually, but I think that's off the top of my head, in losses with this equity allowance. I'd be surprised if Emirates turns a profit. I mean, they're flying empty A380s around the world. And well, you know, Qatar Airways, you know, well, they're currently undergoing an embargo with their air traffic, and they can't fly over the UAE and Saudi Arabia and certain areas like that. It feels like it's a very uneventful argument. I struggle to see what the American airlines are actually achieving by this. It was a point I actually wanted to bring up more for Brian to answer, because he's Mr. United, isn't he, of the aviation world. So I was interested to see what his take on it would be. I mean, having lived out there and witnessed firsthand what it is, I can understand it is a bit of a jealousy, I guess, from American airlines. As not the company, but a US airline, should I say. But the whole 777X order that Sir Tim is talking about, you know, and he does talk a lot of guff. There's 500 orders for the 777X, and I think 350 of them are all going to the desert, and there's not one has been ordered by a US airline. That doesn't mean that it's not good. It doesn't mean that it's not what they want. Obviously, at this moment in time, it doesn't suit their strategy needs. The other thing that to bring up about it, and that we used to say quite a lot, is that where are the Middle Eastern airlines or the US airlines? Where are they competing? No US airline flies to Dubai. No US airline flies to India direct. And they can't sit there and say that it's not something that we want to end, or it's not something we can compete with, because Air India, I think, have now started flying from Delhi and Mumbai to San Francisco, and they started, I think it was last year, it could have been, at four flights a week. And I think as of July this year, they go up to daily flights. And the other, again, I like to play devil's advocate with this, is let's say they have a closed skies agreement, similar, not too dissimilar to what Canada have with the Middle East, where they can only fly three times a week, is that let's say part of they come up with a new agreement and Emirates and Etihad and Qatar can only fly once a day between their hubs and JFK. With the loss of seats, does that mean that American or Delta United will start flying to Dubai to pick up the slack in lost revenues from these companies or not?
It's a very interesting argument you make.
Yeah, but I think part of it also is, I think some of the American carriers have been reluctant to enter markets because, for example, Delta flying from Atlanta to Dubai, they chose not to do that because they couldn't compete with $700 fares that Emirates was offering. And Emirates according to Delta, was able to offer it because of the subsidies. So if they didn't have the subsidies and they had to charge $1,200, $1,400 for an economy ticket, then Delta would enter the market because it was economically viable for them to do so.
Well, just to spin that one back around on you, American, and we could argue that American, the only reason they are so big is that they took on U.S. Airways, isn't there? When U.S. Airways filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Is that right?
Yes, but they were certainly large before the acquisition. It just made them a tad bit larger.
Yeah.
So it kind of swings and roundabouts a little bit, isn't it? It's a bit like, well, you know, it's like Monarch that went bust just a few months ago. Had they been protected with Chapter 11, they'd still be in business. So, I mean, they can't have it all. They can't say, well, they've got 50 million in subsidiaries, but we can have Chapter 11 bankruptcy and they're not allowed to say anything about it.
Yeah, I think I agree, Mike. What you're saying really fits in with what I've been saying all along, is that we throw around this term subsidy, but it really takes a lot of different forms in a lot of different countries and different circumstances. And yeah, whether it's direct government, here's money, whether it's, guess what, you get to enjoy the benefits of this concept called Chapter 11, whether it's, here's some military development money, here's some tax abatements if you locate your facility here. There are just so many flavors of help, assistance, financial assistance from outside these companies that to me it's almost literally impossible to separate these and to add up the numbers and, you know, fit it all in a spreadsheet and say that, okay, you've enjoyed this much benefit and you guys over there have enjoyed that much benefit. I just don't think it's possible. So to me, it's kind of a defunct concept that we need to get away from, I think, and just compete. And maybe it's, you know, one airline competing against another. Maybe it's the airline and the country that they operate in together competing. I don't know, but just this concept of subsidies just seems so ridiculous. And I mean, partly that's what we saw with the whole Boeing Bombardier thing. I mean, that's a completely different kind of a context, but still it's one company crying foul against another. And it's just, it's not productive. I just don't think it has a future. But, companies are obligated to do everything they can on the for the benefit of their shareholders. So maybe that's why we see these U.S. airlines trying to make this case.
Very, very true. And I came across an article today, and it does kind of bring back your point of what is a subsidiary, isn't it, a little bit? And it was the one with American Airlines and Envoy paying, you know, their staff less than $10 an hour. And in a way, that is a subsidiary for American Airlines because they've got the contract and they can set whatever price they want, isn't it? And they can, you know, they can almost take the cream from the top and leave. Surely that's it. That's pretty much exactly the same as what a subsidiary is. Is it not?
Well, this will continue. I think certainly we're not going to solve this for the global airline industry. But tell us what your thoughts are, those of you listening. What do you think about this issue? Am I crazy? Is Mike crazy? Are all of us crazy? Tell us what you think. Write to us and let us know. All right. I see, David, you've popped in one more story into the show plan. What have you got here for us?
This is breaking news today. And being the most quiet, non-political person on the show, I figured I'd throw in a hand grenade. And that is that they announced that Trump's pilot for the 757 is his number one candidate for FAA administrator. This is one of those ones that came across my screen and I just read it and went, really?
Did it make you laugh or did it make you cry?
It brought three letters to me, my mind. WTF. or as our former co-host used to say, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
That's right. Well, when I saw this, David, I had two questions in my mind. The first question was, is this guy qualified? I mean, I say guy. I don't know if this is a male or a female, but...
Yeah, Mr. Duncan is a guy.
Okay, so it's a guy. So, I mean, is he qualified? Maybe he is. I don't know. The second question was, or issue was, I didn't know that President Trump had any other children who were pilots.
Oh, man, I can't believe you said that. Jeez. But, you know, and it does raise an interesting point that we've been wrestling with for the last knows how many years. But I mean, to your point, the guy may be indeed qualified. I mean, he may be someday the FAA administrator. We may say, wow, you know, the guy really turned out to be good. But you cannot divorce it from the political side of the fact that it came from the president, who nobody really believes has any credibility on anything. And that is what makes it really hard for anybody he might nominate for anything.
Well, does he actually – I guess I don't understand the process. It's just sort of – does he really have an input, or does it – I mean, how does it normally work? You don't normally get – first of all, most presidents up until they get to the United – become president don't have a pilot to nominate. But it was just sort of like out of the blue that it's like, okay, we're gonna nominate, I want him nominated. I don't know how this normally works.
It's the friends and family program.
Yeah, back to my question.
Yeah, in essence, that's really true, David. I mean, they people in Congress, in Washington, in industry will throw a name out and say, well, you really ought to consider this person, that person, and that's pretty much how people are nominated for any of these jobs. It's, again, maybe the guy would be a great administrator, but I just don't think he's ever going to get that far.
Yeah, I had read that he had operated, a corporate flight department, and I also saw somewhere managed an airline. I'm guessing perhaps that was the Trump shuttle, which was a short-lived airline. So I guess he's got some executive experience, but you take a look at the FAA, and here you've got an agency with tens of thousands of people, billions of dollars. I've met three out of the four last FAA administrators. All of them were excellent and had, you know, strong backgrounds. So yeah, I think this is a relevant question. Is he really the best qualified? I suppose the president could just nominate him, but it sounds like he may have people doing interviews, because this story said that Mr. Duncan was being interviewed. So I guess they're trying to vet a variety of people before they put a name into nomination.
But going back to the first post about privatization, would this be a way of Trump possibly shooing his way in, I guess, to pushing the ATC towards privatization? With Mr. Duncan in his pocket.
Oh, I see. Are you saying it might be a Trump ATC?
Yeah.
Another for-profit entity. No, I think specifically, Rob, is this supposed to be nonprofit? I don't recall.
It is intended to be a not-for-profit organization, but of course, most of the people within the FAA do not support, I mean, they might not say it publicly, but they do not support this issue of corporatization. Being, you know, obviously they're looking at jobs either going away or the whole thing changing, so they don't like that. But even the FAA managers group has said we don't like this at all. So, but again, having an administrator that came from the Trump organization, I would think that would be just one more piece of pressure that would be difficult to overcome.
But for sure, I think he would be a strong advocate of the privatization.
Oh, I would think so.
All right. Well, I'm going to draw this segment to a close.
Oh, because, yeah. Let's talk to Mike.
Yeah. Anytime we talk politics too much, we get a lot of hate mail, and I don't like reading the hate mail so much.
Oh, baloney on them. It's our show. We can talk about whatever we want.
And any hate mail can be directed at me because I put the story in, so I'll take full blame.
That's right. And if any hate mail comes along, just give them Mike's email and we'll just forward it right up. So, yeah. Hey, Mike, I have a quick question for you. When you come to the U.S., do you find it difficult to fly in the U.S. because of the accents that we have when we speak English?
Not really. I mean, I've got this accent. I mean, that's hard enough as it is.
You've got an accent?
I struggle to understand myself half at time. No, I mean, it's not too. I mean, Boston's a bit of a difficult place to go to, isn't it? They're all very polite up there for some reason.
Yeah, sure they are.
New York can be a little nutty because they speak at warp speed.
Absolutely, yeah, they're a bit difficult. Yeah, well, I went in there once on with a previous company, and we got shouted at for someone. And it wasn't me, but we got shouted at for some unknown reason, and the Arabic first officer didn't have an absolute clue what he was saying. He was like, you need to slow down, and he couldn't. He's like, if I speak any slower, blah, blah, blah. He went off on one. He says, if I speak any slower, I haven't got time to talk to anyone else. And sat in the back thinking, Christ almighty, what a joke.
Sometimes it's a little bit of a challenge. I spent most of Saturday in an Irish bar in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And I tell you, ordering beer is kind of difficult because the bartenders had this thick Irish accent that was difficult to decipher. But anyway, so let's talk about the Boeing 787 Dreamliner. Mike, you're flying. How many years, how long have you been flying the 787?
I'm coming up now. I started at the end of 2014. We had our first one delivered at the end of 2014, which went into service at the start of 2015. So what is that now? Coming to just over three years now. I've been on the 787. I'll be on the Dash 9.
Right.
I haven't been on the Dash 8 just yet, but it's just been the Dash 9. But I've also had the privilege of flying both the Gen X versions and the Rolls-Royce engines, which are on the current ones that we have.
Can you notice any real difference from the cockpit?
No, nothing at all. There was a small differences course that I had to go through, but I mean, it's nothing that self-study can't go through. On the Gen X version, they use what's called an EPR, which is engine pressure ratio. And then on the Rolls-Royce, they use TPR, which is turbine pressure ratio. When you spool the engines up on the Gen X, you take it to about 40, 45% N1. And then on the Rolls-Royce, you just take them to about 20 or 25. They're roughly about the same power. It's just a different mode of measurement, I think, more than anything else.
Well, when you found out that you were going to be flying the 787, what were you thinking? Or what were you feeling, rather? Were you apprehensive? Or, I mean, just what are the emotions or what are the feelings that you as a pilot go through when you find out that you're going to be flying this brand new aircraft with all of its advanced features and everything? What was going through your head?
Relief.
Relief? Why is that?
I wouldn't have to go back into the A330, which was, you know, mate, pure bliss. But at the time, no, it was a bit of a proud moment. I was to be on the entry into service crew for the first one to the company, which I thought was very nice. It was also part of the training as well involved was obviously going through different company SOPs, working with the manufacturer as well. We also had guys come over from Qatar Airways that helped us through some of the training department stuff. So it was different. It was exciting. And it's also kind of why I then wanted to move into training as well, because some of the sim stuff that we used to go through, the full flight simulator stuff and the static flight stuff, it gave me a sense of enjoyment, you know, kind of being a bit of a test dummy for these SOPs that we'd go through. It was good fun, and I enjoyed it. And that's one of the reasons now why I've kind of moved towards the training department. But I think, yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it. It was a bit of a different grip from the Airbus to the Boeing. I can't always say that when I first saw a 787, I thought it was aesthetically pretty. But no, once I saw one in the flesh, it was good. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the transition period. It was good. Didn't take long. I think it was 7 or 8 weeks, I think it took us. For transition period, and then we kind of had a bit of a break in between it. Ours got delivered, I think it got delivered just after Christmas, but it didn't go into service until about the 4th or 5th of January, I think. But then that 10 days we sort of had it, we took it on a lot of base training. Great fun, MT-787s with little fuel on board and a nice long run where you could do stuff. But yeah, thoroughly enjoyable. I think the overall experience was, yeah, they're coming to think about it now.
What does do stuff mean?
Do stuff. I mean, that's for our eyes only.
Okay, just checking.
That's the stuff where you sit in the galley on a tea tray, and, you know, when your mate is giving it full beans at the front, and you're zipping down in a tea tray and see how far you can get. That's doing stuff.
Mike, how much difference is there in the training that you undertook as part of the entry into service crew compared to the training that pilots might receive today? Does that training evolve much after entry into service?
Not really. Hmm. I think there is bits and pieces that come through, like directly. I mean, when the aircraft first came into service, there was a couple of issues here and there that I think was throughout the whole Boeing fleet. And we would get different directives that would come through on a weekly basis or a monthly basis or daily basis. It could be from anything from, let's say there was one directive at the top of my head about the cabin doors. Always make sure that for depressurization, you'd have to crack them first, wait a few minutes, and then have to open up. And that was more for a cabin crew directive, but obviously being your flight crew, you still had to go through these. And that was mainly due to the lower pressure altitude, and the cabin would condensate a lot quicker on arrival, especially back into the Middle East where, you know, you could be arriving in 45 degrees of heat. So there was little things like that. As for flying training, let's say, no. When you bring an aircraft into service, you obviously will have your manufacturer's SOPs, and then also they have company SOPs. I think it's mainly compared to the first time that I first kind of went through the type rating course when I was younger. I think it was more a case of this is how we do it on the Airbus, as opposed to being on an entry into service. It's more a case of this is how I think we should do it, but let's give this a try. And then, oh, well, hang on, how does this work? Does this work in a more efficient way or a coherent way? Or, you know, and it, like I said, that kind of gave me the drive then to kind of want to move into training, because it was enjoyable being the kind of a guinea pig.
Is that move into training something that you had to request, or, I mean, was that difficult to pull off for you?
No, not really. At the time, I mean, I applied for as a TFO, which is a training first officer. So it's mainly a case as a TFO, you're helping the ground study side of it. There's not much sim work. I mean, you may observe a few sessions every now and again. But mainly the TFO is just ground school, demonstrations, so on and so forth. And then once you move into your TRI, type rated instructor, that's when it's a bit more hands-on, a bit more forward, getting involved with people and kind of showing what you know, showing them what they should be doing. And I really enjoy that. I really enjoy that aspect of the job.
You know, of course, one of the things that we talked about in the past frequently, especially in the early days, is the 787 battery issue, the lithium ion battery issue. And of course, we all know that some changes were made to the batteries themselves, but also a containment system and a venting system, and all that. Does that whole situation cause you any concern, or are there any special procedures that were added into the training to deal with that kind of runaway lithium ion battery issue?
Not entirely, no, because I think by the time that I moved on to the 787, the fix or patch, however you wish to describe it, had already put in place stainless steel casing around it and the venting system as well. I don't think they're ever going to find a fix for it. You're asking a lot of the batteries to do a lot of work. Hmm. The 787 is almost the hybrid of the skies. You know, you think about how much has been taken away hydraulically with having the electric on board. You're asking a lot of work to be done. It's only actually this evening, having sat down, that I actually worked out and actually did a bit of research into how the lithium ion system works, which, I mean, having seen the videos and, you know, you go through your training departments of what can happen and what's, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen. I mean, it's very straightforward. You divert, emergency, request assistance, slides, and that's it. You get everyone off, and that's all you do. There's nothing else you can do. And, you know, even to a point there that now that I saw that you can't disconnect the battery. You're not meant to disconnect the battery. You're not meant to cut the wires. You're just meant to leave it. The fire service at most stations now will have a special Halon-style foament that they can put in there. But I just think it's a case of that there's nothing much they can do to resolve a thermal runaway. It is very kind of, once it goes, it goes. On board, we have like the lithium-ion protection bags, which our cabin crew use. So obviously with the Samsungs or the iPhones, which I'll use them now, you put the device in. We think it's a litre of water or a litre and a half of water. And then you top it up as is when needed to cool the device. It's mainly all you can do with them is cool them. But I think once they go, they go. I was watching the Grand Tour earlier in the year, and they had a Rimac, the car was called, and that had 8,000 cells of batteries on board, and that had a crash, and it took 5 days for them to put it out.
Oh, my.
And, I mean, in comparison to have, we've got 16 cells on board. So, I mean, we've seen the damage that can be done with them, but the last noted incident was a United flight from Washington to Paris 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago, roughly. I think they've contained it the best they can do, and I don't think there's anything dramatically moving forward they can do to make it better.
Yeah, Mike, with those containment bags that they have for the phones, have you seen them in action in that how are you supposed to pick up a phone that's burning and calmly put it in a bag after you've filled it with your liter and a half of water and just manage that whole thing? It just seems like it's still a high emotional, stressful event that could just really lead to a bunch of bad things happening.
It's a very good point, because the whole issue with the battery with lithium ion is that it's more a case of overheating. So if you're sat on an airplane, for example, we've all been sat there and we'll be watching a film as phone just sits on the desk or the table or wherever. Now, that's not a case for it to overheat. A case for it is to overheat is to have it on, you know, let's say it's in your jeans where it's a very hot area, or if it's on charge. Now, back to your point, Brian, if you're sat on board and it's in your pocket and all of a sudden your phone gets hotter and hotter, and then all of a sudden you're kind of in that thermal runaway situation, how are you going to stay calm enough to whip your jeans off and then all of a sudden put it in a litre or a half of water in a bag and then, like I said, calmly just carry on topping it back up? It's a situation that isn't going to happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not a situation that's going to be very simple. They right. do have fire protective gloves on board that they can use, but again, it's back to that situation of how far down the line has that thermal runaway got to be before you realise it's in thermal runaway. Can you understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's kind of my question is, so if the thing's been burning for 30, 45 seconds, then the flight attendant goes to get the gloves, to get the bag, to fill it up, and another minute and a half has passed at this point, and I don't know, it seems like a dicey situation to me.
It is, and that's exactly that. It is a dicey situation. But, I mean, I think it's the best of a bad situation is what they can offer, and I don't mean that in a wrong way. I mean, there is not many cases of iPhones and Samsungs and iPads bringing planes down over the Atlantic, and I don't think, touch wood, it's not going to be a case. But I think you also always need to have that backup in place, whether it is only a case of we can keep it cool until we can divert and we can get somewhere safe, or even a case of can we get to our final destination? And I think that in itself is, especially the way that technology is moving forwards, is something you need to have in place.
Yeah, interesting subject that we've been talking about this sort of thing for years, it seems, and with no end in sight. Mike, one of the things we wanted to touch on, especially because you're doing training now, is the pool of student pilots. Are you finding in your airline that there are enough candidates coming in to meet the demand? Is the pilot shortage something that you feel?
Not entirely, no. But I think for the company that I work for, we're in a very lucky position that we're kind of a company that people would like to work for. So we're not going to be short of applicants through the door. The other thing to take into consideration with that is that not long ago, I was with Monarch Gwen Bust. We've taken 50 or 60 pilots from Monarch who went bust last year. So there is always that kind of recruitment there. There is a whole pool there, I'd imagine, as well. So they're not going to be short in coming forward for applicants. I was a lucky one, I guess, that I was straight through the door, and that's good, no matter which way you cut it. But there is obviously people out there that will be looking for jobs. I don't think, especially at higher levels of employment, the likes of my company or others in the UK, they're going to be short of applicants. If we turn it around, on the other hand, the lower cost airlines, EasyJets and the Ryanairs, they're always going to be crying out for pilots. But I think that is the norm with life. It is career progression. People want to move up. People want to move to fly heavy metal, and people always want to strive for a better career. The pilot shortage will always be felt somewhere, and sadly, it is always going to be felt at the lower end of the scale. And I think, especially in Europe, that is the basic be-all and end-all. You know, we do strive for betterness, no matter where you're from. I'm sure it's the same in America. I don't think Delta or United, American, especially the mainline, isn't going to be crying out for pilots, whereas, the regionals, the Southwest perhaps, Frontier and Spirit and the likes, again, it's the bottom end, it's the career ladder, it's the start of the career ladder. People always want to move on and better themselves. And I think, again, like I said, the lower end of the ladder is where there's always going to be a shortage.
All right. Brian, do you have your famous one last question?
Oh, there are so many that I wanted to get into the differences between the A350 and the 787 and, side stick versus the yoke and flying with a HUD and all that. But the show's running long, so unless if Mike has a really quick answer for any of that, no, we'll let him go to bed.
And we're going to stay up. I don't know what you're on about.
Good. Yeah, Mike, maybe you can tell us a little bit about sort of differences between the 787 and other large commercial aircraft. What are the big things that come to mind from your perspective?
The differences between them. I'm yet to go on an A350, so it's unfair for me to comment too much on it. But I think the 787 and the A350 is the first step towards new technology. I think that we're heading down more electrical power, more reliance upon that, less hydraulic. We're looking at lighter materials now, easy to fly. We can now fly further. I think, Qantas start Perth to Heathrow as of 2 weeks' time. Brian, didn't you go to Singapore in a Singapore A350 a few weeks ago?
No, it was a United 787 that I did the LA-Singapore flight.
That's still 17 in the bell, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we're now connecting different parts of the world because of this light technology. We go back to the lithium ion battery. It was brought in because it was lighter than the previously made nickel batteries that they brought. Between the two, it's a bit difficult to compare them. I think they're both on about the par, really. Obviously, I'm a 787 guy. I love my 787. I just think that Airbus have fallen into the root of the 787 a little bit from when they made it. I don't think it's a way that they wanted to go, I'm guessing. And they were kind of pushed that way by some of the airlines. But I think, in all, they've done a good job. I've just seen the delivery flight of the A350-1000. It looks a bit better now that it's longer, I've got to admit. I'm not a massive fan of the 900 shorter version. But, needs must for this economic climate, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, I think the same could be said about the 787. To me, it looks short. The 9 looks much more like the aircraft should.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when the 8 first came out, I wasn't a fan. I've got to admit, I wasn't a fan of the 787 when it first came out. It just looks a bit too short for its needs. Mm-hmm. And the nine looks a nice kind of fit. Yep. But then I think the 10 looks a bit too long. I think they've stretched it a bit too far, I think.
The 9 is what, 20 feet longer than the 8?
Yeah, I think it's about that.
I think it's 18, but yeah, right around there. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the seating in economy, Mike? Is it 9 across?
It's 9 across in economy, yeah. Yeah, positive it's 9 across, yeah. And I think the A350, have they gone with a 3 and a 4 and a 3? Is it they've gone with? But I mean, I think their cabin's an extra. I think I've read somewhere that the XWB is it 26 inch wider than a 787, the cabin?
Hmm.
I think they've read that correctly.
Sounds right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
The company that I do work for now, they did the early long flight for the A350 1000. And by all accounts, they said it was fantastic. It'll fit in nicely at Heathrow. And I think now they've kind of got the right shape with it. I think there'll be many years to come with it. There's never going to be a better one between Boeing and Airbus, I'm afraid. The only thing I can say about them is that Airbus have copied Boeing for the last, I don't know, 50 years. And the only thing that Airbus did differently were an A380, and look what that's happened. It's starting to get parked in the desert now, aren't they?
Mm. All right. Well, Mike, we want to thank you for coming on the show, talking to our audience. Is there a way we can follow you online? I think you're on Twitter, aren't you?
I am on Twitter, yeah, as at FOMike787. I'm on Twitter. That's about it, really. I do a bit of Twittering. I do a bit of picture posting. And that's it, the excitement of my life.
All right. Great. Thanks again, Mike.
More than welcome.
That was fun, Mike. Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Brian, we have a great airline story of the week this time. What are we looking at here?
Yeah, and I think this one kind of fits in nicely with Mike and his experience. And so I want to follow up with a question at the end if he's ever experienced anything like this. But this was on an American Airlines flight where a passenger handed a note to the flight attendant, and it reads, "I have a big favor to ask. I just found out that I'm pregnant, and I really want to surprise my husband. I was hoping you could announce it before takeoff. His name is David Rose, and he's sitting in 28E. If you could give me a quick cue that you are about to announce it, I'll get my video camera ready. If you don't have time to do it," and I'm sorry, just interrupting her. I think this is one of the best parts about the letter, in that because she said, "If you can't do it, that's fine." And I think that's probably part of the reason that they went through and actually did it. So giving them an out, I think, was really good. So she writes, "If you don't have time to do it, I understand. But if you can, it will be amazing." And so the captain gets on and makes an announcement that there's an additional passenger on board. And Audrey was filming her husband, and he was in complete shock, thinking that one of his other children was on board the plane, but it wasn't. There was the bun in the oven that was the extra passenger, where the seat count didn't match. But I just thought it was great that the American pilot took the time to make the announcement and really make the moment special for Audrey's husband. And the look on his face in the video was just absolutely fantastic.
Nice story. All right. We'll have that, the link to that story in the show notes. Yeah. You can see the video. It really is fun to watch the expression on that husband's face.
Yeah. So Mike, has anyone ever asked you to make a special announcement or do anything like that?
Nothing, to that extent. No, but we get, birthdays, honeymoons, happy retirements, stuff like that, but nothing to the extent of pregnancies, nothing like that. No marriages or anything like that just yet, I'm afraid.
Give it time. I imagine everything will happen eventually on an airplane if you just wait long enough. All right. Let's see. What's up with the geeks? Rob, you been doing any interesting things lately?
No.
No? Okay. Who's next?
No, actually, I was down in Florida last week, and boy, I'll tell you, as luck would have it, I ended up in Fort Lauderdale on the same day we had that awful shooting here in the States, and it just put a real damper on everything. But I did go back and do a little visiting over in the area. I used to work at Opa-locka Airport, which is now Opa-locka Executive Airport. And it was nice to go home after so many years and see how the place changed, and went up to visit a buddy of mine at Fort Lauderdale that has started a seaplane operation there. And that was a lot of fun. And also, I think I've got something interesting. What am I doing this week? Oh, I'm going to see. I had to think about that. I'm headed out to visit the Bose audio people in Massachusetts. What's the name of that state, Max?
Massachusetts? Just call it Mass and you'll fit right in.
I'm going to Boston, Mass. I'm going to Boston, Mass on Wednesday. So that'll be a lot of fun. I have no idea what I'm going out there for. It's all secret at this point. So I can't wait to find out what the secret is.
All right. We received an email from one of our listeners, Will. Will is a 13-year-old who wrote to say that he's got an idea for a project he's working on. And we asked Will if he would just send us a little teaser about the project that he's working on in the future segment that we hope to get from Will. So let's listen to him.
Hi, geeks. My name is Will. I'm 13 years old and I live in the UK. I'm sorry I couldn't get this to you sooner, but I'm actually at boarding school, so unfortunately I don't have that much time. But I'm hoping to do this project on Soviet-era aircraft and why they kind of got a bad rap in today's society, although they're just as amazing as their kind of Western counterparts. I aim to educate your listeners on ATER engineering feats and espionage that affected not only the people of the Soviet Union, but of many other countries besides. I'll briefly talk about the history aircraft in the Soviet Union, and then I'll focus on a few individual planes. I think your listeners will find this interesting, as when I'd read about it, was inspired to do this project. I realised I'd seen very and heard very little about this genre, if you will, of aircraft. Personally, I enjoy reading the Airliner World magazine, Plane Spotting, and School. I hope your listeners will enjoy listening to my segment as much as I am enjoying making it. I hope to hear from you soon. Thanks. Bye.
This guy is how old?
He's 13. Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
Yeah.
What an articulate fellow. Listen, I can't wait to hear this segment when it comes out, even though I don't know anything about Soviet era aircraft, but then that's what we're going to have him for.
Yeah, I think it's a great project. We're really excited, Will, to hear about your project and educate us, educate Rob, and educate all of our listeners as well. Very exciting. Very exciting. Now we have an interview that Launchpad Marzari did. Launchpad, of course, is our reporter at large for the Airplane Geeks podcast. And he spoke with the commander of the 302 Squadron of the Dutch Royal Air Force, which you'd think maybe that would be in the Netherlands, but 302 Squadron is actually operating in the United States. So here's the conversation that Launchpad Marzari recorded.
Hello, airplane geeks. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, and I'm here with a special guest today. I'm here with...
Ik ben Luitenant-Kolonel Peter Grijsbaard van de Nederlandse Luchtmacht 302 Squadron.
And for those of you who weren't reading the subtitles, that's Lieutenant Colonel Peter Krijsbaar from the 302nd Squadron of the Dutch Royal Air Force. Sir, before we continue on, let's turn on the Google Translator for our audience.
I can do that. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Peter Krijsbaar, and we're with the 302nd Squadron in Robert Gray Army Airfield.
Very good, sir. Now let's get to the obvious. Why are the Dutch at Fort Hood?
Yeah, of course. That is a good question. Actually, we are all already here for a really long time. We started here in 96 when we bought the Chinooks and the Apaches. We like to get trained by the U.S. Army. So we went to reach out, and we finally got the answer that 21st Cav Brigade, that was a unit that was specialized in training Apache units, because all the U.S. Army units was all or also transferring to the Apache. So we ended up in Fort Hood, where 21st Cav was located at Hood Army Airfield. And actually, we got there with a whole, and that time it was called the 301st Squadron. So we ended up with the whole squadron, all the pilots and all the mechanics to be trained by 21st Cav in Apache operations. That's how it all started in 96, and we actually never left.
Okay, because that I think you answered the question is why here and not Fort Rucker, the home of Army aviation?
Yeah, that's a good question too. But every Dutch pilot who flies helicopters will start at Fort Rucker. But Fort Rucker is not for mission training. It is for aircraft qualification. So you learn how to fly the helicopters. What we do in Fort Hood, since this is far more of a tactical base, with tactical airfields and gunnery ranges, et cetera, here we do not learn the pilots how to fly the helicopters, because that's what they did in Fort Rucker and in the Netherlands. But as soon as they finish in Rucker and the Netherlands, they come over to Fort Hood, and we learn them more like how to fight with the aircraft, how to tactically operate with the aircraft. That's what we do in Fort Hood.
And you covered it real quickly. What types and models of aircraft do you have here?
Yeah, we have. We started with the Apache only. In this case, we have now the Delta model Apaches over here. We're transferring to the Echoes. So we have eight Apache Deltas over here. And later on, it was almost in 2000, we also introduced the Chinook over here. And we have four Chinook F models over here.
Very cool. Now, these are Dutch aircraft, right? Or are they leased from the U.S. government and or Boeing?
Yeah. No, we started out with leasing some Apaches. And that was because we were in the process of buying the Delta models. So we started out with leasing Alpha models, the old types. But as soon as our aircraft was ready and came from the production line, we really bought the aircraft. So all the Chinooks and Apaches are Dutch-owned and not leased. So the aircraft we have over here, too, they're Dutch aircraft, but American-made, of course.
All right. Now, let me ask about your training here. Is it organized by class or unit? Unit, normally we think of like a cohort where a whole unit comes over to time.
Yeah, it is a bit of both, actually. What we do is we have two types of trainings over here. Let me start with a basic one, that pilots or aircrew, I should say, because it's Chinook and as well as Apache crews, come over from that when they trained in Fort Rucker in the Netherlands, they come over and then we give them a course, and that's called the Mission Qualification Training, MQT. And in the MQT, that's that phase where we learn them how to fight with the aircraft. And that is primarily focused on aircrew. That is also loadmasters from the Chinook, pilots from the Chinook, and pilots on the Apache. The other training we provide is when those guys are ready, they go back to the units. And within the unit, for an example, our Apache squadron, that's the 301st squadron, they have five flights with pilots. Every flight comes over to the States for 1 month. And we call that the Exercise American Falcon. They combine it with an Apache flight, a Chinook flight, and a COI from an air mobile brigade. And all those three entities get a rigorous training, and that's what we call the American Falcon, for 5 weeks, where we train them in all the missions, and also we qualify them. So we look if they are deployment combat ready. Can we really send them out to the war theaters? Normally, a lot of times, side by side with the U.S. Army. So we do that rigorous training for 5 weeks over here. And after those 5 weeks, mostly we also certify them that they're combat ready for deployments.
Okay. Now, during the Falcon exercises, is that joint exercises with the U.S. Army?
Well, mostly it's Dutch-oriented. So we train those Apache guys, Chinook crews, and the infantry COI. But where we can find cohesion with the U.S. and train in close co-op with the U.S., then, for an example, we use American JTACers, forward air controllers, if you can get them. We work with the UAVs from the U.S. If we can, we also work sometimes with Black Hawk or Medevac helicopters from the U.S. So we try to combine it as much as possible.
All right. For your students, How much flight time is a student getting when he's here on his class?
Yeah, when we do the MQT, it's combined, it's almost about 200 hours. So it's about an 80 to 100 hours per student when we do the MQT. When a class comes in and do the American Falcon, they fly about 60 hours per crew member.
How long is an MQT in that syllabus?
Yeah, that's a good question. I forgot that. That's about a 10-week period. So an MQT is 10 weeks. We do them twice a year. And the American Falcons are 5 weeks, and we do 4 of them a year. So almost the whole year is filled up. Sometimes we have 1 week in between those courses, and we have some block leave in the summer and during Christmas.
Okay, so since you're teaching them how to fight, is it all flight time, or is there any simulator time in there?
Yeah, we do both, because we have simulators which we can use here on Hood, and we also have a simulator now in Houston. But it is mostly flight time. So we focus more in the Netherlands that they do most of their simulator time. When we have them over here, we try to focus as much as possible in flight time. And especially we also try to give them as much night time as possible, because that is one of our biggest challenges in Europe, in such a dense country.
That's what I was going to ask, is why fly in what kind of flying can you do in Texas that you can't do at home in the Netherlands?
Yeah, that's a question we got a lot, of course. Actually, the Netherlands is very crowded. It is very densely populated. Same goes for a lot of exercise areas. We are lacking in Germany and Belgium, and wherever we can find them, we'll try to hit those exercise areas. But they're very hard to get, yeah, because a lot of countries want to exercise, and noise abatement is really a big thing in Europe. So, and over here, it's a tremendous area. It's almost the size of the whole Netherlands, which we have as a training ground, let alone for all the shooting areas, the fight houses, the shoot houses, we call them, for the army we're getting in. So we have so much possibilities over here. So that helps out a lot. So that is a great way for us to do a lot of training, and especially night flying, low flying training. And of course, we're careful also in the States. We cannot do everything over here, and we also have our procedures where we have to really think about noise abatement, etc. But the possibilities are great for us over here.
All right, let's talk about your cadre. How many instructors and staff do you have here?
Yeah, that's a complete mix. That's very complex even. But we have in our Dutch staff, we have 27. I'm sorry. There, 7 of them are Dutch Army. The other 20 are Air Force. But then we're also supported by DACs, we call it, DECKers. That is Department Army Civilians. So there's civilians working for the U.S. Army. We have 7 of them, and we're extending to 10. And we have contractors. So we have 4 companies working for us on different departments. One of the companies supplies us with maintenance. One of them supports us in flight support. One of them does the OPFOR, and one of them is simulation equipment. So all those, and that adds up to about 200 total, that is U.S. contractors, so civilians, that support our program.
What's the best part or your favorite thing of flying in the U.S.?
Yeah, I cannot say my favorite part of flying in the U.S. Well, I already mentioned the big exercise areas and the possibilities of gunnery ranges, so all those possibilities. But what really stands out for us is how much help we get in this case, especially Texas, and how big patriotism, so you said it correct,
yes,
is in Texas. That is amazing. Guy, thank you for your service. They really appreciate that you're in the military, that we fight side by side with the U.S. Army. This is amazing to see, yeah, how much support we get and how we are also really being a member here of the military, although we are foreign and we're from the Netherlands. That is the best part for me.
Now, what do you miss about flying in the Netherlands or in Europe that you can't do here?
Sometimes what we miss is the bad weather. And that sounds really stupid, of course, because everybody likes to fly in good weather. But for the young students, we sometimes miss that bad weather. Because when you're trained in Europe, there's a lot of shitty weather out there, to say it with a good Dutch word. So that's a lot of times Texas is so great, and that is also the best part, of course, because the weather is so helpful that you almost don't have weather days, as we call them. It's almost every time that you are able to fly. But the bad weather in the Netherlands is sometimes we really need again for the students to get them acquainted again with bad weather procedures. And that is quite a different flying, especially at night.
How are you legally flying in the U.S.? Let's get geeky. This is the Airplane Geeks. Are you flying on an EASA license, an FAA equivalent license? How do you guys get to fly over here?
Yeah, that's a good question, of course. What we do have is we have NATO pilot licenses. Yeah, so it's also we're a NATO member. So as soon as we fly in other theaters, etc., we fall back to NATO procedures, but also to NATO licensing. Yeah, so the Dutch flight licenses, in this case it's called an MPL, military pilot license, is also certified to fly in the U.S. Can you fly immediately? No, because you have to adhere to the U.S. regulations. So the pilot license is granted in the States, but for procedure-wise, for an example, weather limitations, we use the Fort Hood weather limitations, for an example, not the Dutch limitations. Yeah, so it is a mix of Dutch and U.S. regulations, but we comply with all the U.S. regulations we have to comply with to be able to fly with. But for an example, the pilot licenses, they are officially, how do you say that? They're
equivalency?
Yeah, equivalent, yeah, so they're supported by the U.S. also.
Okay, so there's a reciprocity agreement.
Yeah, and also the same goes for the aircraft. Yeah, the whole status of the aircraft has to be in compliance with the U.S. Army. But that is really easy because they're American aircraft and they're maintained via the U.S. Army regulations. Yeah, because our contractors, they're certified by the U.S. Army. And also the oversight and the check and balance on my mechanics of that company who is supplying is done by the Department of the Army civilians because they act as representatives of the U.S. government. So they oversee my maintenance guys.
Do any of your staff or fly outside of work for, you know, take advantage of living here in Texas and the big open sky?
Yeah, we have the guys with our civil pilot licenses over here, eh, because that is not complied with the U.S., so you have to get your civil pilot license, CPL, etc. But some of our guys do glider flying, some of them fly the small planes. But not a lot, because we are able to fly over here, of course, military-wise, and that eats up a lot of time. But some of them do. Especially I know two guys who do glider flying and one also flies on small airplanes like Cessnas and stuff.
My last question I've got for you is, what's the funnest thing you've gotten to do here in America for, you know, flying and having, you know, getting to be the commander?
Yeah, that is a good question, of course. What was a highlight last year? Of course, we do a lot of great training, but we do that in an extended way, and we do that all year. What was a unique opportunity is that Circuit of the Americas couldn't find a U.S. unit to do the flyby. So we did that flyby for the Formula One of the Circuit of Americas, and there was also a Dutch driver who was getting better and better. So we were able to support him, and we really liked that, the U.S. Army in this case, to fulfill that task, to do that flyby. So we did it with the Chinooks and the Apaches, and for us that was a unique chance. We could land over there and also see the race. So that was really a great event for us.
Oh, such hard duty to do a flyby of the Formula One and then land on the track and get your free pass to go to the Formula One.
Well, actually, since this is for Air Force Geek, or for Airplane Geeks, I should say, you also have a lot to lose. Because if you screw up a flyby, in this case, about 100 million spectators on television see that you screw it up. So there's also a lot of pressure. So it also even is good training. But I would lie if I wouldn't admit it, of course. It was a great experience and it was really fun to do.
Well, thank you, sir. Again, we're talking with Lieutenant Colonel Crespa, the squadron commander for the 302nd here at Fort Hood. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
All right, very cool. We want to thank Launchpad Marzari for recording that interview. Fascinating look at the 302 squadron. Of course, as we say, if you have an opportunity to speak with someone who's got some interesting things to say about any topic of aviation, think about recording a little segment for us and sending it along to us. We do have some other listener mail that we received. We got an email from Jeanette Remack. You may remember her as a past guest from Phoenix Aviation Research. And when we last spoke with her, she was in the process of finishing up a book, and it's out now. It's called Black Lightning, The Legacy of the Lockheed Blackbirds. And so that has been released. It's by herself, Jeanette Remack, and also Joe Ventolo. And we'll have a link in the show notes. You can get that on Amazon.com and probably some other places as well. So take a look for that. And then we received an email from Philip. He said, I know you've spoken about the shortage of pilots across the industry and was interested to see that my national airline, Qantas, is establishing a pilot academy. Now, this is the Qantas Group Pilot Academy. They say on their website they want to help shape the next generation of pilots. That's why we're establishing the Qantas Group Pilot Academy. It will open its doors in 2019 with an initial intake of 100 pilots. Once it's fully established, we expect to train up to 500 pilots a year. Goes on, we expect the typical entrants to be high school or university graduates with a strong academic performance. After 18 months of classroom, simulator, and real-world flight training, you'll graduate. The training could lead to employment with one of the Qantas Group airlines, including Jetstar. And they're going to be releasing more information, but on their webpage, you can sign up to register your interest. So I imagine that means they'll send you information as it develops. And so we'll have that link in the show notes. Mike, what's the typical training period that you're familiar with for the 787?
Off the top of my head, I think 6 weeks, 6 or 7 weeks, something around that time. I think it's 15 days in the classroom, and then 4 days in the sim, followed by base training, as if you do that, skill set. So yeah, I think about 6 weeks, with the weekends off in between there, around about that time frame. Going back to the Qantas thing quickly, it is nice to see that a big airline is opening up good avenues for employment and aspiring pilots. It's just a shame, though, that more companies around the world can't do such a things for them. It's a shame. But no, good on them. Well done. Well done, Qantas.
Yeah, very nice. And then Philip goes on and talks about the A380 versus the 747. And he's going to have an opportunity later this year to fly on a Qantas A380 from Australia to the U.S. And he'll be changing to a Qantas 747, he says, for the flight to JFK and then from San Francisco back to Australia. So he's going to be on both aircraft, and I think he's going to be able to give us a little bit of feedback, a little bit of a comparison between those two aircraft, and that'll be interesting to look forward to.
Yeah, I'm jealous of the aircraft and the itinerary.
I know. Doesn't that sound like a blast?
Yeah. I still think one of the best experiences I've had, though, was sitting in the upper deck on a 747. I just really, really like that cabin layout. And I'd actually prefer flying up there than being in first class down below. There's just something special about upstairs. And it's really sad that that the 747's going away from that perspective.
Yeah, I flew in the upper deck a couple of times. And one of the noticeable things, or notable, I guess I should say, is you know, the absence of children. So it was very quiet. If you wanted to work, you could work. If you wanted to sleep, you could do that without too much distraction. You're in a smaller space, and it just it had a nice comfy feel to it. At least that's what I found.
Yeah, it was a nice private. Yeah.
What are you saying? You don't like Munchkins?
No, in fact, you know, there was an article that I saw today that some airline somewhere is looking at a child-free zone or section, let's say, in the aircraft. And I didn't read the article. I don't recall what it is, but I'm sure it wouldn't be too difficult to find. I think a lot of business travelers especially would really appreciate, you know, that kind of a for most business travelers, you're working when you're on the plane, and if you can do that without all these distractions, that's a big advantage. All right, we have one more story that came in from listener Jason. And David, what did Jason have to say?
Guys, I saw this and I thought it's not a traditional positive airline story, but still one worth sharing. Pilot lost his daughter in the Parkland shooting, and over 100 colleagues came to her funeral. United Airlines Captain Tony Montalo and his family had a funeral for their daughter, Gina Rose, on Tuesday at Mary Help of Christians Church in Parkland. Employees from multiple divisions of United, JetBlue, Spirit, American Airlines, and FedEx attended to honor the young girl's life. They lined up together in uniform. The pilots created an image of true solidarity. There were no specific plans for what we did. It just happened out of love and respect for the suffering of a family member of our United and aviation family, he told CNN. And Jason follows this up with, your show has become truly one of my staples during the week. Thank you for all the effort you put in. This was pretty incredible. It reminds me of too much of a aviation geek version of what happens with a loss of a police officer or a loss of a fireman, where they were full uniform dressed and respected the father and honored their daughter for a very difficult, stressful event.
Yeah, and I think the great part about this story is there is a lot of rivalry with the airlines, but they put all that crap aside and just became human for a bit and really honored the girl. And that was awesome.
Yeah, very moving, very moving. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Mike. He's a senior first officer, currently flying the Boeing 787. Mike, again, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I hope I didn't embarrass myself and gave everyone what they wanted to listen to. But no, once again, many thanks for having me on.
All right. Be sure to visit us at airplanegeeks.com. There you can find out how to contact us, how to subscribe to the podcast, learn more about us, and especially see the show notes where we have links to all the stories we talk about, the articles that our listeners send us, all of that and more. For this episode, you'll find at airplanegeeks.com/492. Well, let's tell everybody where they can find us online. And Max Trescott, let's start with you.
Well, they can find me at aviationnewstalk.com. And I should mention that I've got a listener questions segment at the end. So anybody who wants to record a listener question, just click on listener questions at the top of the page, and I'll try and answer it on the show.
Do you ever get people asking you questions about, like, us?
Yes, and I don't put those on the show.
Oh, good.
I was just going to say the same thing. If he does, I've never heard them.
That's right. We have a large editing department.
Good, of one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right, Rob Mark, where do we find you online?
Oh, they'll find me at any place that has Jetwine in the name or something that has Flying Mag in the name, either behind the pages or online. And I think that's probably it.
David Vanderhoof, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Facebook, if you can spell Vanderhoof. And, of course, you can find me on that show with Max Flight talking about UAVs on the UAV Digest on Friday mornings.
And Brian Coleman, how do we get in touch with you?
Oh, when I'm not being awe-inspired by the drones in the closing ceremony of the Olympics. Can't believe no one mentioned that tonight. Best way to get a hold of me, because I'm still not social, is send me an email at brian@airplanegeeks.com.
Cool. All right. Yeah, the Intel drone performances at the Olympics were pretty spectacular. You can find me at, let's see, where can you find me? You can find me on Twitter at MaxFlight. Look for me in LinkedIn, also, as David says, at the UAVDigest.com. And also with Mary Kirby on the PaxXPodcast.com. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. You're listening to him now. You can find more of his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at BrunoMassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
Yeah, all that stuff. Thank you.
Fly Boeing, not Airbus.
And thanks for listening.
I thought the saying was, if it ain't Boeing, we ain't going.
There's that too.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Right. Is there an equivalent for Airbus? I mean, to the, if it ain't Boeing? Boeing, I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, shit.
Shit.
I bet Mike's a lot of fun when he gets a couple of pints in him.
Say, that'd make Captain Nick so happy to hear that.
I know, yeah. I was...
Yeah, there's quite a few. I had 5 years on them. I didn't mind the A340. The 330 was just utter shite.
What was it about the A330 that was so unappealing to you?
Don't know. And that's the weird thing about it. It was a bit of, I don't know what it is. It was just it never suited my eye. I never liked it. I think it felt a bit easy to under rotate. So you'd quite often slam it into tarmac at said destination and requiring you to set Michelins on it. but yeah, no, I had the 340 I enjoyed. Yeah. But it was because of the 330 that I actually got onto the 787. I was off sick for a short period of time and I lost my currency on the 330 and just was only single qualified on the 340. So I had a blissful couple of months just flying that around Europe. It was fantastic. And I came back from, I think it was Seoul, Korea, in South Korea, actually.
Yeah.
And one of the managers pulled me aside and went, right, you've got two options here. You can go on to 787 or you're going to get your multi-crew rating again. And I was like, oh, I'm not going back into that heap of shit. So I thought I'd go on to Boeing instead.
How's the automation on the 787?
Easy.
Yeah.
Easy, yeah. I mean, the only couple of things that kind of the differences between them are few and far between. At the end of the day, they both do a good job, and I think that's they're both safe. They both get it to where they want to go, and I think that's the main thing. But you look at an Airbus; they've got to complicate things.
Hmm.
It's very French, you know what I mean? An FMC. We all know what an FMC is. But because it's an Airbus, it's got to be called an FMGS, Flight Management Guidance System. Why? Why the need for an extra letter?
Huh.
You know, what's the point?
Yeah,
they've got to change everything. You know, they're all too busy surrendering during bloody war to realise what was going on, weren't they?
Jesus.
And it's, who was it mentioned Dutchies earlier on?
Yeah.
Who mentioned that? Yeah?
Yeah.
What's the thinnest book in the world?
What's the what in the world?
The thinnest book. Any winners on this one?
No.
Dutch war heroes. There you are.
Dutch war heroes? Careful now. Vanderhoof is Dutch, so.
Well, German humor is right up there. And I think great English cooks is the other. And,
well, I was going to say great Irish cooks.
Well.
Probably the same.
Okay, we've insulted the Vanderhoofs and the O'Neills in my family. Anything else you'd like to go? Would you like to go for the Scots?
What's the biggest county in England? Scotland.
David, we can make fun of Philadelphia pretzels, too, if that'll make you happy.
Philadelphia's a cheese, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that, too.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I got to go, guys. I'll see you all later. Mike, it was fun listening to this. Next time I get over to Britain, I'm going to make sure I look you up.
Definitely. You know where I am. You're all welcome.
Yeah, somewhere at that airline with the 787.
Yeah. We've now got four on the ground, so I won't be doing much work, will I?
You got four? Four AOGs?
Four AOG, yep.
Oh, out of how many?
15.
Ouch.
That's terrible.
And they're all on the ground for different reasons?
Three of them don't have any engines on. And one of them got withdrawn on Sunday because it was pissing fuel out of the center fuel tank.
Oh, so the leak, yeah.
Did, does anybody in operations realize that flying them without engines is really difficult?
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, I went and spoke with Craig Krieger, who's our CEO, and I saw him last year at some point. He says, "How do you think we can improve the Airbus fleet?" And my response was, "Set fire to it." But I think he's having the last laugh now with four AOG 787s.
Oh my god!
That's a tough way to make money.
Yeah.
Well, unless you're Boeing.
We've just had one back. GV Naps just come back, and there was a picture put online, and it was in horrific state when they took it out of service. And I was speaking to one of our engineers, Eddie. He's only been in service 2 weeks. The registration is GV Nap, and they've already re-registered GV Crap. It's horrendous. Came in from JFK on, I don't know what it was, Saturday, and the number one engine wouldn't turn off by the master switch. So we had to, the QRH stated he had to pull the fire compressor unit. It's just sort of pissing smoke everywhere over Heathrow.
It's a hell of a way to shut down an engine.
Yeah. So they spent the rest of the day running ground tests on it. So they're well impressed with that one.
That's
wow.
So,
all right, I've got to go because I'll never stop laughing if I don't get out of here. All right, see you guys later.
See you later, buddy.
Bye, guys.
Yep, bye-bye.